The world of Wall Street, nobody wanted to do business with him. Deeply embittered by this rejection, Gavin Williams made it the decision to devote the rest of his life to the pursuit of those who had made it to the top, cataloging their misdemeanors with crazed zeal. In the early days, working at the SEC had given him a tremendous sense of purpose, but all that changed after Madoff. The agency's failings in that case were catastrophic. Gavin himself hadn't worked on the case, but he felt tainted by collective embarrassment, blinded by a simple Ponzi scheme. The thought of it still gave Gavin Williams sleepless nights, even now in his new dream job as the FBI's top man on securities fraud. Peter Finch said, "It's not yet clear. On the surface, the accounts looked clean, but after the Brooksteins disappeared, all Quorum's investors wanted their money back at once. It's those redemptions that have revealed this black hole, and it's growing by the day." "But there are billions of dollars missing here." Harry Bain scratched his head. "How can that kind of money just evaporate?"
"It can't. Maybe it got spent.
Or lost, siphoned off into speculative, unprofitable private businesses controlled by Leonard Brookstein and his cronies. More likely Brookstein stashed it away somewhere. That's what we've got to find out."
"Okay."
Harry Bain's quick mind was working.
"How long before this gets into the press?"
Finch shrugged.
"Not long. A few days, a week at most. Once investors start talking, it'll be out there. I don't need to tell you the implications this could have on the wider economy. Quorum was bigger than GM, almost as big as AIG. Every small business in New York had exposure. Pensioners. Families."
Bain got the picture.
"I'll handpick a task force of our best men to work on this today. The instant new information comes in, you pass it on to Gavin. Gavin, you report directly to me. None of the information discussed today is to leave this room. Understood? I want to keep the media out for as long as possible. The NYPD, too. The last thing we need is those idiots running around sabotaging our case."
Peter Finch nodded. Gavin Williams sat frozen, his face impassive, inscrutable. Harry Bain thought, "I feel like Jim Kirk working with Spock." He felt the familiar rush of adrenaline at the prospect of spearheading such a vital operation. "If I track down that money, I'll be a hero. I might even get a shot at the directorship." Harry thought about his wife, Lisa, and how proud she'd be. "Of course, if I fail..." But Harry Bain wouldn't fail. He had never failed in his life.
"There's a trustees meeting next month, Grace, on the 26th. I think it's important that you be there if you can bear it."
It had been 2 weeks since Grace's return to Manhattan, and John and Caroline Merrivale had invited her over for supper. When she declined the invitation, Caroline drove over to her apartment and frog-marched her into a waiting cab. Grace looked pained.
"Can't you deal with it, John? I won't understand a word they say, anyway. Lenny always handled all the legal things."
"You must go, Grace," said Caroline. "John will be there with you, but you're the sole beneficiary of Lenny's estate. There'll be things you need to approve."
"Am I the sole beneficiary?"
Caroline gave a short, derisory laugh.
"Of course you are, dear. You were his wife."
Grace thought, "I'm still his wife. We don't know he's dead yet. Not for sure." But she didn't have the energy to fight about it. Grace couldn't help but notice that Caroline had gotten rather bossy since the accident. Whenever John spoke to Grace, he was firm but deferential. "I really feel so and so. If you can, you should try to do such and such." Caroline was much more autocratic. "Do this, say that." Still, perhaps that's what I need right now. God knows I don't seem able to make any decisions for myself. Grace agreed to meet the trustees. It was hard to pinpoint exactly when the change started. Like all these things, it began almost imperceptibly. First the flowers stopped coming, then the calls. Invitations to lunch or dinner began to dry up. On the one day that Grace tried to make an effort and drag herself out of the apartment, she went to the tennis club for coffee, she noticed many of her old girlfriends avoiding her. Tammy Rees practically broke into a run when she bumped into Grace in the powder room, mumbling the quickest of, "How are you?" before scuttling out the door. Grace tried to talk to her sisters about it, but both Honor and Connie were distracted, distant almost. Neither had the time to chat. Grace even called her mother Holly, a sign of desperation if ever there was one. It was a mistake.
"You're probably imagining it, darling. Why don't you go on a lovely cruise somewhere? Take your mind off things." "I met Roberto on a cruise, you know. One never knows when Cupid might strike."
"A cruise? I won't set foot on a boat again as long as I live." The next day, Grace's platinum Amex card was declined at Bergdorf Goodman. Grace felt herself blushing scarlet as the woman in line behind her stared.
"I think there must be some mistake," she said meekly. "I have unlimited credit."
The sales girl was kind.
"I'm sure it's just a mix-up, Mrs. Brookstein, but you'd best take it up with American Express. I'd be happy to keep the bag on hold for you if you'd like."
"I don't want the stupid bag. I only came here to try to distract myself for 5 minutes, to forget about Lenny as if I could ever do that."
"Thank you. That's okay. I'll go home and sort this out."
Grace called Amex. A drone told her that Lenny's account had been terminated.
"What do you mean, terminated? By whom? I didn't terminate it."
"I'm sorry, ma'am, but I can't help you. Your husband's account has been closed."
Worse was to come. Bills started arriving for unpaid services. An unpleasant man rang the apartment and informed Grace curtly that her mortgage payments were 5 months in arrears.
"I'm sorry, sir, but I think you must have me confused with someone else. We don't have a mortgage."
"Mrs. Brookstein? It is Mrs. Brookstein I'm speaking to, right?"
"Yes."
"The outstanding balance on your mortgage is $16,762,014. That's in your and your husband's joint names. Would you like me to resend you the statements?"
It wasn't until Conchita, Grace's loyal maid, quit over her unpaid wages.
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Brookstein, but my husband, he won't let me keep coming here, not unless you pay me."
That Grace finally overcame her embarrassment and confessed her money worries to John Merrivale.
"It's insanity," she sobbed on the phone. "Lenny's worth billions, but suddenly I'm getting all these bills. No one will take my cards. I don't understand it."
There was a long silence on the other end of the line.
"John? Are you there?"
"I'm here, Gracie. I think perhaps you better come over."
John Merrivale was nervous.
even more nervous than usual. Grace noticed the way he kept scratching at his neck and his eyes rarely met hers. She sat opposite him on the couch in his study as he began to explain.
There have been rumors for some time now, Grace. Rumors on Wall Street and among our investors. After what happened, the FBI became involved.
Grace's eyes widened.
The FBI? Why? What sort of rumors?
Lenny was a brilliant man, an uncannily shrewd investor. One of the reasons for Quorum's success is that he never divulged his strategy. Like most of the best hedge fund managers, his model was a closely guarded secret.
Grace nodded.
He told me it was like inheriting your grandmother's recipe for spaghetti sauce. Everyone who eats it tries to figure out the secret ingredient, but you can never tell.
Exactly.
John Merrivale smiled. She really is a child.
My job was to raise funds for Quorum. With Lenny's performance, that was easy. We were turning away money. It was Lenny's job to invest those funds. No one, not even me, knew exactly where he put the money. Until his disappearance, it had never really mattered.
But afterward?
Despite its size and huge success, Quorum was still fundamentally a one-man show. When Lenny disappeared, people wanted to withdraw their capital. A lot of people, all at the same time.
And that was a problem?
John Merrivale sighed.
Yes. A lot of the money is, we don't know where it is exactly. It's unaccounted for. It's complicated.
I see.
Grace thought about this for a few moments.
So, is that why the FBI is involved? To try and sort out the confusion?
John's scratching intensified.
In a way, yes. But I'm afraid there are some unpleasant sides to this. Because of the amount of money involved so large, tens of billions of dollars at a minimum, the police believe that Lenny may have deliberately stolen it.
That's ridiculous! Lenny would never steal! Besides, why would he rob his own fund?
I don't believe he did, Grace. I want you to know that.
John took her hand.
But other people, the FBI, investors, the newspapers are jumping to conclusions. They say that once the SEC started investigating, Lenny knew Quorum would collapse and that he would be exposed. Grace, they're saying that Lenny might have committed suicide.
Grace felt sick.
Suicide? Lenny? No.
Never. Even if he had stolen some money, he would never leave me. He would never take his own life. She struggled to keep her voice steady.
Whatever happened on that boat, John, it was an accident. Lenny was happy when he left me that morning. Why hasn't the FBI spoken to me? I could have told them that.
I'm sure they will want to talk to you eventually. Once a death certificate is issued, there'll be a likely inquest. Right now, the primary focus is on locating the missing money. Until that happens, all Quorum's assets have been frozen, as well as your personal accounts.
Grace looked so small and lost, perched on the edge of the couch. Had John Merrivale been a more tactile man, he'd have gone over and hugged her. As it was, he said,
try not to worry. I know it's hard, but you and I both know Lenny wasn't a thief. The truth will come out eventually. Everything will be okay.
No, it won't. Not without Lenny. Nothing will ever be okay again.
It was the next morning that the storm erupted. Angry investors marched on Quorum's offices, demanding their money back. CNN showed images of a near riot, with mounted police forcing back the mob. Within hours, the likely scale of what was now being called the Quorum fraud was making headline news around the world. Grace watched the television in shock.
Leonard Brookstein, once one of New York's best-loved philanthropists and an American icon, was today being exposed as perhaps the greatest thief in U.S. history. Furious investors in Brookstein's Quorum hedge fund burned effigies of the 58-year-old, presumed dead after a freak sailing accident last month, outside his former offices.
The phone rang. It was John. Grace broke down.
Oh, John! Have you seen what they're saying about Lenny? The news! I can't watch!
Grace, listen to me. You're not safe. I'm coming to pick you up.
But that's crazy! Why would anyone want to hurt me?
People are angry, Grace. Lenny's not here. You're the next best thing.
But, John...
No buts. You must stay with us. Pack a bag. I'll be there in 10 minutes.
10 minutes later, Grace was in the back of an armored town car. As she left her building, a small group of hecklers was already gathered outside. They jeered at her.
Where's the money, Grace?
Where'd Lenny hide it?
Is that $70 billion in your suitcase, baby, or are you just glad to see us?
By the time John bundled her into the car, she was hyperventilating. She never set foot in her apartment again.
No, I won't sell it. I can't.
Grace was in the boardroom of the law firm Carter Hochstein. Around the table were six forbidding-looking men in dark suits. John Merrivale introduced them as Lenny's trustees, the men responsible for overseeing his estate.
I'm afraid you have no choice. Put simply, Mrs. Brookstein, you do not have the money to continue paying the mortgage on the apartment. We are going to have to put all your assets on the market. Historically, your husband funded his lifestyle by borrowing large sums of money against the value of his stake in Quorum. Those loans have now been called in, and you have no immediate means of paying them.
Grace turned to John Merrivale in bewilderment.
But how can that be? Can't I don't know, sell some shares or something?
John looked pained.
The thing is, Grace, until this mess is sorted out at Quorum, you don't have any shares to sell.
Mrs. Brookstein!
Kenneth Greville, the most senior partner, spelled it out in black and white.
You must understand. Vast sums of money remain unaccounted for at Quorum. Hundreds of thousands of your husband's investors have been financially ruined. They've lost everything.
Grace thought, and I haven't?
Until your husband is determined to be legally dead and the criminal investigation is completed, we can't draw any firm conclusions. But it does look increasingly likely that Mr. Brookstein was involved, to some degree at least, in fraudulent activity of a most serious nature. The amounts that were stolen...
No.
Grace stood up.
I'm sorry, but I won't sit here and listen to this. My husband never stole anything. Lenny is not a thief. He's a good man, and he built Quorum up from nothing. Tell them, John.
Kenneth Greville thought. She still refers to him in the present tense. The poor child's delusional.
Your loyalty is admirable, Mrs. Brookstein, but it is my unpleasant duty to inform you of the facts with regard to your current and probably future financial circumstances. You will not be able to continue living at the Park Avenue apartment. I'm sorry.
Tears rolled down Grace's cheeks. She felt as if she were manacled to a runway train. Her life was collapsing around her, and she had absolutely no power to stop it. That evening at dinner, Caroline Merrivale watched Grace staring listlessly at the dining room wall. She'd barely touched her soup and looked thin and drawn.
"Eat up, Grace. In this house we make it a rule never to let good food go to waste, don't we, John?"
John saw the triumphant flash of cruelty in his wife's eyes. She's loving every second of this, turning the tables on Grace at last. She's like a cat with a mouse playing with it before the kill.
"Caroline's right, Grace. You must try to keep your strength up."
Grace brought a spoonful of soup to her lips. It was cold. She fought down the urge to gag.
"I'm sorry. I don't really feel well. If you don't mind, I think I'd like to go to bed."
The sooner today was over, the better. After the meeting with the lawyers, she felt lower than she had since the day the Coast Guard told her the awful news. The whole world was talking about this stupid money.
"As if I care about the money. All I want is for Lenny to walk back through the door."
A maid appeared in the doorway.
"I'm sorry to interrupt, Mrs. Merrivale, but there's a policeman at the door. He says he has urgent business with Mrs. Brookstein."
Instinctively, Grace panicked.
"No! Tell him to go away. It's late. Tell him to come back in the morning."
Caroline laughed.
"Don't be silly, Grace. It's the police, not a social call. You must go out and meet him."
"No, please, Caroline, I can't."
Caroline was unmoved.
"Melissa, show the officer in. Tell him Mrs. Brookstein will be with him momentarily."
A few minutes later, Grace walked nervously into the entryway. She expected to find an aggressive FBI agent there to interrogate her. Instead, she was greeted by a shy young man in uniform. As soon as he saw Grace, he took off his cap politely. Grace felt the tension in her shoulders begin to ease.
"Good evening, officer. You wanted to see me?"
"Yes. Mrs. Brookstein, I have some news for you. It's about your husband. Perhaps you'd like to sit down."
Irrationally, Grace's heart soared.
"He's alive! Lenny's alive! They found him! Oh, thank God! Lenny will come back and everything will go back to the way it used to be. We'll have our homes again and our money. No one will hate us anymore."
"Mrs. Brookstein?"
"Oh, I'm fine, thank you. I've been sitting all day. You say you have some news for me?"
"Yes, ma'am." The young man looked at his shoes. "I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but this afternoon, the Massachusetts Coast Guard recovered a body. We believe the remains to be those of your husband, Leonard Brookstein."
Chapter 8. Donna Sanchez enjoyed her work at the city morgue. Her friends and family couldn't understand it. "All those dead people? Aren't you creeped out?" Their reactions made Donna smile. A heavy-set Puerto Rican woman with fat, sausage-like fingers and a round, doughy face, Donna had grown up in a big, noisy family before starting a big, noisy family of her own. Outside of work, the soundtrack to Donna Sanchez's life was screaming children, smashing crockery, beeping car horns, blaring television sets. Donna liked the dead because they were silent.
The city morgue on Clarkson Avenue in Brooklyn was white, clean, and orderly. It made Donna feel peaceful. Of course, she still had bad days. Even after 8 years, the sight of small children's bodies could make Donna choke up. Some of the accident victims were pretty gruesome, too. And the suicides. The first time Donna saw a jumper, she had nightmares about the mangled corpse for weeks afterwards. Bones erupting through the skin, skull collapsed like a rotten melon. Normally, drowning victims were among the easiest to deal with. Immersion in cold, deep water tended to delay decomposition. Donna also noticed that many of the water dead had a happy, almost beatific look on their faces. Not today's body, though. The revolting, waxy hulk lying on the slab had no face. The fish had seen to that. All that was left beneath the ravaged stump of a neck was a great bloated midsection. The left arm and hand were miraculously intact, but the rest of the limbs had gone, snapped off like crab's claws. It was, as Donna's friends would have said, creepy. Are they really dragging his poor wife in here? Like everyone else at the morgue, Donna Sanchez knew that the cops believed the body was Lenny Brookstein's. That's why it had been brought back to New York, almost 200 miles from where it was washed up on the Massachusetts coast. No one should have to see their loved one like this. Dwayne Tyler, the technician, sneered. A handsome black kid fresh out of high school, Dwayne was a born cynic.
Save your sympathy, Donna! One thing Grace Brookstein ain't is poor. You know what they're saying? This son of a bitch ripped off thousands of people. Ordinary people.
I know that's what they're saying, Dwayne. It doesn't mean it's true. Besides, so what if he did? It's not his wife's fault.
Dwayne Tyler shook his head pityingly.
Don't you believe it, girl. You think the wives don't know? Those rich white bitches, they know. They all know.
Harry Bain and Gavin Williams were in the district attorney's office. It was common knowledge that Angelo Michelle's parents were two of the many New Yorkers facing ruin because of Lenny Brookstein. Angelo was the best legal brain in New York City, but Harry Bain wondered whether, in this case, his judgment might be clouded. The DA's opening words did not reassure him. Well, I wanted Brookstein's head on a plate. Looks like I got the next best thing, his torso on a slab.
It might not be him, said Harry Bain. His wife's on her way to identify the body, what's left of it. Then we conduct the autopsy.
Good. It was the job of the FBI task force to find the missing quorum money, but it was Angelo Michelle's job to prosecute those responsible for the theft. Part of him was pleased they found a body. The possibility, however remote, that Lenny Brookstein might have somehow escaped and be living the high life on a private atoll in the South Pacific had been keeping Angelo awake at night for weeks. But another part of him felt robbed. If Lenny Brookstein was dead, he couldn't be punished. Somebody had to be punished.
Have you got any further with Merrivale or Preston?
No,
Harry Bain frowned.
Not yet.
He had personally interviewed the two senior quorum execs a total of 6 times, but was no closer to untangling the mystery of how Lenny Brookstein had managed to spirit away such insane amounts of money. Instinct told him that both men knew more than they were telling. But so far, he couldn't prove it. Agent Williams has uncovered something interesting, though. Angelo Michelle looked at Gavin Williams. The man gave him the creeps. He was more like a robot than a human being. When he spoke, it was in a monotone, studiously avoiding eye contact. It appears that in the week before his death, Leonard Brookstein changed the company structure at Quorum. Effectively, he arbitrarily stripped John Merivale of his partnership status.
Damn it.
Angelo Michel shook his head. Harry Bain cocked his head to one side. That's bad? Sure. If Lenny Brookstein was the only legal partner, it'll be almost impossible to indict, much less prosecute, the other players. Short of $70 billion showing up soon into Merivale's suit pants, we're fucked. He wasn't the only partner. But I thought you said... Gavin Williams sighed, like a grade school teacher explaining something painfully simple to a 7-year-old. I said Lenny stripped John of his shares. I didn't say he was the only partner. He didn't keep that equity. He transferred it. Angelo Michel's heart was racing. To who, for God's sake? Gavin Williams smiled. To his wife. Donna Sanchez said gently, Are you sure you're ready, Miss Brookstein? Grace nodded.
It doesn't matter. This is all a dream, a nightmare. When she pulls back the sheet, I'll wake up.
We'll do this very quickly. Try to focus on the hand. If you recognize the wedding ring, that's all we need. Donna pulled back the sheet. Grace threw back her head and screamed. John Merivale stared at the documents in front of him, rubbing his eyes with exhaustion.
There must be some mistake.
Harry Bain lit another cigarette. The smoke made John Merivale feel nauseous.
No mistake, John. This is Lenny's signature, and this is Grace's. You don't think we had them checked?
The documents were legal instructions, changing Quorum's ownership structure. They transferred John's entire equity stake in the fund to Grace. They were dated June the 8th, the day before the Quorum ball. Both Lenny and Grace had signed them. Face it, John, the Brooksteins ripped you off. They were planning to grab what was left of the money and run.
No, Lenny wouldn't do that. Not to me.
Read it, John. It's right there in black and white. He did it. They did it together. Don't you think it's time you stopped protecting them?
John squeezed his eyes shut tight. It was so hard to think. How long have I been in this room? 3 hours? 4? He thought about Grace alone at the morgue. The police had refused to let him go with her. The poor girl would be terrified.
Lenny had a legal right to restructure the company any way he chose. Quorum was his business.
Harry Bain looked at him in disbelief.
You're saying you don't mind that Lenny Brookstein robbed you blind?
I'm saying he didn't rob me.
But he did. It's right here in black and white.
He must have had his reasons, then. Lenny's dead. He's not here to explain, to defend his good name.
His good name?
Harry Bain laughed out loud.
Lenny Brookstein! The man was a crook, John. So was his wife. That much we know. The question is, what don't we know? What are you hiding from us?
I'm not hiding anything.
Why are you protecting him?
He was my friend. My only friend.
He wasn't your friend. He used you, John. He used you from the beginning. Why do you think a brilliant guy like Lenny needed a schmuck like you on the team, huh? Do you ever ask yourself that question? All the time.
Because you gave him legitimacy, that's why. Because you are dumb and adoring and blindly loyal, like a dog.
John looked up. It was Harry Bane's face sneering at him, but the voice was Caroline's.
You're a lapdog, John. You're pathetic. Stand up and be counted.
No, I wasn't Lenny's dog. It wasn't like that.
No? What were you then? Because the way I see it, you're either a fucking moron who couldn't see what was going on right under your nose, or you knew.
No, I didn't know anything.
I don't believe you. Where's the money, John?
I don't know.
Where'd you stash it, huh? You and your good friend, Lenny Brookstein, the guy who you trusted so much, who relied on your advice. Where'd you put the cash?
I've told you, I don't...
Maybe it's Andrew Preston we should be talking to. Was Preston the one Lenny really trusted?
Of course not. Lenny was almost much closer to me than Andrew.
So close that he gave your shares to Grace?
A high-pitched whistle in John's head was getting louder, like a boiling kettle.
Where is it, John? Where's the money? If you weren't Lenny's little dog, then prove it.
The whistle was so loud he thought his eardrums would shatter.
Where's the fucking money, John?
I don't know!
Slumped over the table, John Merrivale broke down into sobs.
For God's sake, what's the matter with you? I don't know!
On the other side of the two-way glass, Angelo Michele turned to the psychologist.
What do you think?
I think he's telling the truth. He doesn't know anything. When he saw that partnership document, it blew him away.
Angelo Michele nodded.
I agree. I wonder if that automaton, Williams, is having any more success with Grace.
Where were you when you signed the documents?
Grace tried to focus. Still reeling from the shock of seeing Lenny's body, she found it hard to remember where she was. The gruff, gray-haired man sitting opposite her was from the FBI. He'd arrested her as she left the morgue and driven her somewhere, but she couldn't remember where or how long it had taken. Now she was in a white, windowless room. Images of Lenny's mutilated corpse flashed through her mind like a horror movie. The man kept talking.
They're dated June 8th.
Lenny's skin, waxy and white, like the stuff that covers the skin of a newborn baby.
Mrs. Brookstein, these documents prove that you knowingly made yourself a partner in Quorum International LLC with a view to profiting illicitly from illegal trades made between 2004 and 2009.
Lenny's swollen finger, the skin bursting around his wedding ring.
What do you know about the whereabouts of the profits from the following transactions? 2005, Innovation Management 6-Year Fund of Funds executed in Grand Cayman.
I don't know anything.
Grace's voice was barely a whisper. Gavin Williams leaned across the table till his face was millimeters from hers. Grace smelled his sour breath.
Don't lie to me, Mrs. Brookstein. You will regret it.
Grace looked up and saw the compassionless void in his eyes. A cold stab of fear ran through her.
I'm not lying.
You were a partner in your husband's fund.
A partner? No, you're mistaken. I was never a partner. I don't know anything about business. It was Lenny and John.
Do you deny this is your signature?
Angrily, Gavin Williams shoved a piece of paper across the table. Grace recognized her own writing, but she couldn't for the life of her remember what the document was, when she signed it, or why. Lenny handled all of that.
I don't deny anything. I'm confused.
Gavin Williams was shouting. 2005. Inspiration Grand Cayman.
I want my attorney present.
Grace was shocked to hear the words come out of her own mouth. I sound like a bad episode of Law and Order. What?
I said I need a lawyer.
Gavin Williams seethed with frustration. He'd hoped that by catching Grace at such a vulnerable moment, he'd be able to bully her into a confession, get her to break down. But if she wanted a lawyer, he could not deny her one. Bitch. Interview terminated. Turn off the tape. With a look of disgust, Gavin Williams left the room. The following morning, news of Grace Brookstein's arrest and the recovery of Lenny Brookstein's body was splashed all over the papers. Honor Warner shook as she read the report.
They found Lenny's body.
Yes, I know, said Jack, deadpan.
I can read.
How can you be so calm about it? The FBI has arrested Grace. Have you seen the list of charges? The things they're accusing her of? Securities fraud? Money laundering? Grace can barely add 2 plus 2. What are we going to do?
Jack smiled. Do? We're not going to do anything.
But Jack...
But Jack what? We're going to wash our hands of your little sister and walk away. Honor looked horrified. Jack laughed at her.
Oh, please, don't try to pretend to me that you care about Grace. It's a little late for that, darling. Did you think I couldn't see through you all these years?
What do you mean?
You think I don't know how much you hate your sister? How much you've always hated her?
Honor looked away, ashamed. It's true. I do hate her, but to let her go to jail? She tried another tack.
All right, let's forget about Grace. What about us, Jack? If Grace goes on trial, there'll be questions. Questions about Lenny's business affairs, his associates, what happened the day he disappeared. What if the police find out?
They won't.
But what if they do?
Jack looked at her coldly. Do you want to be First Lady, Honor? Honor did want it. More than anything. Do you want to see me in the White House?
Of course. You know I do.
Then stop panicking. Keep your mouth shut and your head down. Lenny's dead. He can't hurt us anymore, but Grace could. God knows how much the old man may have told her.
Honor shivered. She hadn't thought of that.
Your sister going to jail could be the best thing to happen to us. Now, pass me the coffee, wouldn't you? It's getting cold. Michael Gray was horrified when he heard the news. Instinctively, he put his arms around Connie.
I'm so sorry, honey. Is there anything I can do?
Connie shook her head.
What can anyone do, Mike? Obviously, Lenny and Grace were not who we thought they were.
Michael Gray looked surprised.
You don't seriously think Grace is guilty of these charges, do you?
Connie shrugged.
I don't know what to think anymore. The world's gone mad.
Yeah, but money laundering? Grace?
I don't see what's so impossible about that. After all, look at Lenny. We all loved and respected him, but it turns out he was nothing but a thief and a coward.
There was a venom in Connie's voice that Michael had never heard before. It frightened him. We all know Grace was obsessed with Lenny.
Who knows what she might have done to protect him or to help him?
Maria Preston treated Grace's arrest like an exciting episode in one of her soap operas. The police are saying that Grace stole John Merrivale's partnership, that she and Lenny were planning to rip him off as well as the investors and run off with all the money. Grace Brookstein is the Quorum Fund's only living partner. That's what it says here. That makes her legally responsible for all of Quorum's losses. Can you believe that? Andrew couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe any of it. Since that fateful trip to Nantucket, he'd barely slept. I've been lucky so far. The FBI has bigger fish to fry, but the knock on the door will come eventually. I know it will. It wasn't exposure itself that scared him, or even prison. It was losing Maria. Everything he'd done for her. And she thinks the whole thing's a game.
I think I'll wear my new Dior to the trial. The fuchsia one.
We're not going to the trial.
Not going? But Andy, everyone will be there.
Jesus, Maria, it's not a fucking Broadway show. It was so rare for Andrew to lose his temper. Maria just stared at him. She rather liked this new, macho Andrew. Billions of dollars are missing. The feds are all over us like a rash. Everyone at Quorum's under suspicion.
Well, they won't be any more,
said Maria cheerfully, cutting herself another slice of panettone. It looks like the FBI has found its sacrificial lamb. Sweet little butter-wouldn't-melt Gracie is going to jail. Andrew thought, I hope so. Then realized what a terrible thought that was. When had he become so callous, so cold-hearted? I don't recognize myself anymore. Oh, Maria, what have you done to me?
You're not going to jail, Gracie. Let's get that straight from the get-go. You're innocent and you're going to plead innocent, okay?
Grace nodded weakly. It was all so confusing. Frank Hammond seemed so upbeat, not like our first lawyer, Kevin McGuire. Kevin was an old friend of Grace's parents from East Hampton. Grace called him the day she was arrested. She wanted him to rescue her from the bullying agent with the dead eyes, and he had. But once they were alone, he didn't pull his punches.
As a full partner in Quorum, you're legally liable for Lenny's actions, whether you actually made any decisions or not,
Kevin told her. You have to plead guilty.
But I never even knew I was a partner.
Kevin McGuire was sympathetic but firm. Ignorance might be a moral defense, but it wasn't a legal one. You signed the contract, Grace. If you don't take responsibility, the judge may be even harsher at sentencing. He was firm about bail, too.
My advice is not to seek it.
Grace couldn't believe it.
You mean you want me to stay in jail? But it could be months before the case gets to court.
Oh, it will be months. And I know it's tough, but believe me, Grace, you're safer in there. I don't think you fully appreciate the anger people feel towards you and Lenny.
He was right. Grace didn't. Apart from the small crowd who heckled her when she left her apartment to stay with the Merrivals, she had little or no direct contact with the outside world since she returned to New York. John refused to let her watch the TV reports and did not allow newspapers in the house. The day after the coroner officially ruled Lenny's death a suicide, Kevin McGuire had shown Grace some of the headlines she'd been shielded from. Brookstein took coward's way out. Despicable con man commits suicide, cheats justice. Brookstein's most hated couple in America. A week ago, the headlines would have shocked her.
Now, having been through the horror of identifying Lenny's body, Grace doubted anything would have the power to shock her ever again. Instead, she felt numb. Dissociated.
Are they talking about Lenny? About me? How can people hate us? We haven't done anything wrong.
As for the idea of Lenny committing suicide, well, that was just ludicrous. Anyone who had ever met him knew that Lenny loved life. He would have clung to life to the bitter end, no matter what. It was an accident, a freak storm. No one could have predicted what happened that day. Kevin McGuire kept trying to get her to focus on the present, to acknowledge the fact that she may well be sent to prison. But Kevin didn't understand. Prison didn't frighten Grace. It didn't matter what happened to her. Without Lenny, nothing mattered anymore. The world could hold no joy for Grace, no hope. They may as well lock me up. My life is already over. Once again, it was John Merrivale who had ridden to her rescue and made her see sense. The whole world was accusing Grace of betraying him, of conspiring with Lenny to steal his stake in Quorum, but John's loyalty remained unwavering.
It's a mistake, Grace, all right? A mistake. I don't know why Lenny did it, but he must have had his reasons.
You know, he would never have tried to cheat you, John. Neither of us would.
Of course I do, sweetheart. Of course I do.
When John heard the advice Kevin McGuire was giving Grace, he forced her to fire him on the spot.
But Kevin's an old friend,
Grace protested.
I dare say, but he's talking nonsense. Plead guilty indeed? That's insanity. We need to get you Frank Hammond. He's the best.
John was right, as usual. Frank Hammond burst into Grace's life like a cyclone. From the moment she met him, Grace felt her hope returning. She began to see light at the end of the tunnel. Here, at last, was her champion, a strong man, an advocate, someone who believed her and would fight for her. Just being in Frank Hammond's presence made Grace feel better. She asked shyly,
"What about bail? Do you think there's any chance?"
"I've already applied. The hearing's tomorrow. I'm going to get you out of here."
"You do realize I don't have any money. I can't pay you."
Grace was embarrassed, but Frank Hammond was unfazed. "Forget it. It's taken care of. Now, I want you to listen to me. Can you do that?" Grace nodded. "Forget about charges against you. Forget about the trial. Forget about what people out there are saying. It's my job to straighten all that out. Understood?"
"Understood." He's so reassuring, I feel like I'm talking to Lenny.
"Your job is to hold on tight to the truth. You did not steal any money. Lenny did not steal any money. The fact that a whole bunch of money has gone missing means that someone must have stolen it. Whoever that person is framed you and your husband. That's our case."
"But who would do that?"
Frank Hammond smiled, revealing a row of jagged, yellowing old man's teeth. Clearly, he did not spend any of his astronomical fees at the dentist's office. "Who would steal $70 billion? 99% of Americans, if they thought they could get away with it."
"All right, then. Who did steal it?"
"I have no idea." "It doesn't matter. All we need to do is establish reasonable doubt. The DA has to prove that you and your husband were responsible. Grace was silent. After a few moments, she asked,
Mr. Hammond, do you believe my husband killed himself?
Frank Hammond looked his client directly in the eye.
No, Mrs. Brookstein, I do not.
From that moment on, Grace knew she could trust Frank Hammond implicitly.
He's going to win the case. He's going to set me free, and when he does, I'm going to find out who stole that money and clear Lenny's name.
Chapter 9. Grace Brookstein played with the buttons on her Chanel Boucle jacket as the jury filed back into Court 14. She was nervous, but not about the verdict. She knew she would be found innocent. Frank Hammond had told her so.
Just do exactly what I tell you, Grace, and leave the rest to me. The jury will acquit you.
When Frank spoke, it was like listening to the voice of the prophet. Grace had followed his instructions to the letter, even down to her courtroom attire.
It's not your job to look contrite. You're innocent. I want you to walk into that courtroom proudly, with your head held high. Remember, you're representing Lenny as well as yourself.
Lenny, darling Lenny. Are you watching, sweetheart? Are you proud of me?
No. Grace's nerves were not about the verdict. They were about what would happen once the case was over.
How am I going to find out who framed Lenny?
So far, the FBI had conspicuously failed to track down more than a few million of the missing Quorum money.
If they can't find that money, what hope do I have?
But she had to do it. She had to clear Lenny's name. He'd been gone 6 months now. It was already December, almost Christmas.
My first Christmas as a widow.
Despite being Jewish, Lenny had always loved Christmas. The present-giving, the parties.
He had such a generous spirit.
The judge's voice sounded distant, unreal. He addressed the foreman of the jury.
Have you reached your verdict?
I suppose I'll spend Christmas with the Merivals.
Christmas was a time for family, but both Grace's sisters had let her down badly. Neither of them had called or visited since she'd been arrested. Grace had half hoped, half expected to see them in the public gallery when the trial started, but Connie and Honor were both conspicuous by their absence.
Once I'm found innocent, I'm sure they'll come back to me. When they do, I'll forgive them. I'm going to need their support if I'm going to put things right, if I'm going to find out who really stole that money, who framed my darling Lenny.
The foreman looked at Grace and smiled. Grace smiled back. He seemed like a nice man.
How do you find the defendant on the charge of security fraud?
Guilty.
District Attorney Angela Michelle punched the air. So there wasn't a strategy. Big Frank Hammond just screwed this thing up. He's not so invincible after all. Grace started to feel the first stirrings of panic. She looked at Frank Hammond, but his eyes were fixed on the judge.
And on the charge of money laundering?
Guilty.
I'm not guilty. This is a mistake. I did everything Frank told me to.
On the charge of perjury, wire fraud, mail fraud.
The words tore into Grace like razor blades.
Guilty, guilty, guilty.
This is wrong. Please, Your Honor, this is all a mistake. I'm innocent, and so is my husband. We were framed.
The boos and catcalls from the public gallery were so deafening Grace could barely hear her own words. It took a full minute for the judge to restore order. When he did, he turned to Grace with a chilling anger.
Grace Brookstein, between you and your husband robbed your investors of an almost unimaginable sum of money. The human suffering brought about by your actions has been profound. Yet, at no point have you shown the slightest remorse. You seem to have taken a view that, because of your privileged position in society, the laws of this great nation do not apply to you.
They do.
The gallery roared their approval. Grace could hear the muffled cheers from the crowds gathered outside, watching the proceedings on specially erected screens.
Your decision to plead not guilty in this courtroom, knowing the overwhelming evidence against you, compounds an already despicable crime. It is this utter disregard for the law, as well as for the pain your victims have suffered, that has informed my decision with regard to your sentence. I do not doubt that your denial of any knowledge of your husband's business practices is a lie that you have shamelessly repeated both to this court and to the authorities struggling to repay your husband's victims. For this, I intend to see to it that you spend the remainder of natural life deprived of your freedom.
The judge was still speaking, passing sentence, but Grace no longer heard him. What the hell happened? What went wrong? Frank Hammond sat beside her, slumped over the table, his head in his hands. As she felt the bailiff's grip tighten on her arm, Grace looked up at John Merrill. He mouthed the words, "Don't worry," but his stricken face said it all. Even Caroline, who'd been cold and unsupportive in the run-up to the trial, looked shocked. Grace felt sick, not for herself, but for Lenny.
I've failed him. I've let him down. How am I ever going to prove his innocence now?
On the steps of the courthouse, Angelo Michelle was being mobbed. Throngs of people pressed forward to shake his hand and pat him on the back. He had avenged them, avenged New York, avenged the poor, the dispossessed, the homeless, avenged all the victims of the Brookstein's avarice and greed. A reporter pulled Harry Bain aside. Look at Michelle. They love him. It's like he's Joe DiMaggio back from the dead or something. The guy's a rock star.
He's more than that, Harry Bain said. He's a hero.
For Angelo Michelle, the show was over, but for Harry Bain and Gavin Williams, it had barely begun. They still had to find that money. Chapter 10. Grace Brookstein's conviction and life sentence, the cumulative punishment for all five charges, was over 100 years in jail, was the lead item on news reports around the globe. Grace was no longer a woman, an individual with thoughts and hopes and regrets. She was an emblem, a symbol of all that was greedy and corrupt and rotten in America, of the forces of evil that had brought the country to the brink of economic collapse and caused so much suffering and anguish. When Grace was taken from the courtroom to await transfer to the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women, she was jostled and jeered by a bloodthirsty mob. One woman managed to scratch her face, her talon-like acrylic nail slicing into Grace's flesh. Images of Grace Brookstein clutching her bleeding cheek as she was bundled into a police van were beamed across America. The mighty had truly fallen. After a terrifying night alone in a cell, Grace was allowed to make a phone call at 5 a.m. On instinct, she reached for her family.
Gracie?
Honor's voice sounded groggy with sleep.
Is that you?
Thank God. She's home. Grace could have wept with relief.
Yes. It's me.
Oh, Honor, it's terrible. I don't know what happened. My attorney told me it will all be okay, but...
Where are you now?
I'm in jail. I'm still in New York. I don't know where exactly. It's awful. They're transferring me tomorrow somewhere near you. Bedford, I think. That might be better, but Honor, you have to help me.
There was a long silence. Eventually, Honor said, I don't see how I can, Gracie. You've been found guilty in a court of law.
I know, but...
And you didn't exactly help yourself during the trial. Your clothes? What were you thinking?
Frank Hammond told me to wear them.
You see, there you go again. Connie was right.
What do you mean?
Grace was close to tears.
Connie was right about what?
About you. Listen to yourself, Grace. Lenny told me. My attorney told me. John told me. When are you going to start taking responsibility for your own actions? Your own life? You're not Daddy's little princess anymore, Gracie. You can't keep expecting me and Connie to fix everything for you.
Grace bit her lip till it bled. She needed her sister's support so desperately, but all Honor wanted to do was lecture her.
Clearly, Connie felt the same way.
Please, Honor, I don't know where to turn. Can't you ask Jack? He's a senator. He must have some influence. This is all a terrible mistake. I didn't steal any money, and Lenny would never...
I'm sorry, Grace. Jack can't possibly get involved. This sort of scandal could ruin us.
Ruin you? Honor, they're locking me up. Lanny's dead, accused of a crime you know he didn't commit.
I don't know that, Grace. For God's sake, wake up. That money didn't just vanish. Of course Lenny took it. He took it and he left you holding the bag.
The words were like a knife in Grace's heart.
It was bad enough that strangers thought Lenny was a thief, but Honor knew him. She knew him. How could she possibly believe it?
Honor spoke her next words with a chilling finality.
You made your own bed, Gracie. I'm sorry.
The connection was broken. You're sorry? So am I. Goodbye, Honor.
The ride on the prison van to Bedford Hills was long and uncomfortable. The van was freezing and smelly, and the women inside huddled together for warmth. Grace looked at their faces. These women had nothing in common with her. Some were frightened, some defiant, some despairing. But all wore the haggard lines of poverty and exhaustion on their faces. They looked at Grace with naked, murderous hatred.
Grace closed her eyes. She was 9 years old in East Hampton with her father. It was Christmas Eve, and Cooper Knowles was lifting her up on his shoulders to put the star on the top of the tree.
You can do it, Grace. Just stretch a little further.
She was on the podium, aged 15, surrounded by her gymnast friends. The judges were placing a gold medal around her neck. Grace scanned the crowd for her mother's face, but she wasn't there. Her coach told her,
"Forget it, Grace. If you want to be a winner, you have to win for yourself, not for others."
It was her wedding night. Lenny was making love to her, softly, tenderly.
I'm going to take care of you, Grace. You'll never have to worry about anything ever again.
And Grace replied, I love you, Lenny. I'm so happy.
Get out,
The female guard grabbed Grace roughly by the arm. Grace hadn't even noticed that the van had stopped. Moments later,